Episode 32 with Alan Brown.
Where meditation meets daily life, this is the Meditation Freedom Podcast.
Thank you so much for tuning into the Meditation Freedom Podcast. My name is Seeker Rode. And today we're going to be talking about mindfulness in education with Alan Brown. And Alan Brown has a lot of good things to say about mindfulness and its learning outcomes, but also its outcomes in terms of making the students more conscious and aware and awake, as well as the outcomes in their personal lives and perhaps the rest of their lives and their careers. Here's a little bit about Alan Brown and what he does. Alan Brown is a dean at Grace Church School in New York City, where he also leads the 9th through 12th grade mindfulness program. And he also leads the parent mindfulness program. And Alan has taught in both public and private settings as a humanities instructor. And in addition to his academic degrees in the humanities from Johns Hopkins University and the University of Chicago, Alan also holds additional certifications in teaching mindfulness, positive psychology, and yoga. Alan currently works with schools as well as with families to help bring mindfulness into the lives of youth and their caregivers. And just a little bit about the program that Alan refers to in this interview called Mindful Schools. This was a program that got started in 2007 and then turned into a nonprofit in October of 2010. And this nonprofit organization's goal or mission is to lead the integration of mindfulness into education. They've trained educators, social workers, psychologists, parents, and other adults from over 60 countries, impacting more than 200,000 youth globally. So basically, they're developing mindfulness into schools as what they call an inner compass, a true lifetime skill that's highly preventative. And they mentioned that understanding one's own thoughts and feelings can save massive future expenditures to address juvenile delinquency, poor academic performance, stress, mental disorders, etc. They're saying that basically having a mind that's calm, focused, and empathetic allows these students to increase their scholastic aptitude, particularly if they experience a high degree of stress outside of school. And so then they use this mindfulness curriculum, which brings improvements in concentration, attention, empathy, while building a climate of calm in the classroom. And you'll hear more about this with Alan's experience as a teacher and administrator. Here's the interview with Alan Brown. Thank you so much, Alan, for joining me in this podcast.
Thank you.
I got to your name through somebody from Mindfulness Schools because you're one of the people that are implementing this in schools. And maybe just for starters, what I'd like to do is ask you how you got to a mindfulness or meditation practice in your life.
Sure. I'm maybe a backdoor meditator. I came in through yoga. I know I'm not alone in that. At first,
right.
The physical practice, and really wasn't until I actually did like a yoga teacher training that I really kind of had to do a lot more sitting and became a little bit more familiar with contemplative practices rather than just movement practices. And at the time I was working in, I've been teaching in high schools for many years, but at the time, I was teaching in a particularly high anxiety population, high stress, high achieving school. That it just sort of felt to me like this makes so much sense, both in terms of what I'm feeling in the school, like I'm right. really busy and whatnot. I happened to be doing the teacher training in the summer, so it was just such a real different energy to my summer, and then I kind of came back to the school and found myself just sort of craving, wow, I need a lot more stillness for myself. And of course I'm watching kids just going nuts and spinning their wheels and feeling this would be helpful for them too. But But yeah, I came in through yoga, and it wasn't actually until I started really wanting to share the practice with students that I had to really learn and deepen my own meditation practice.
Right. And just for curiosity, how did you get, what kind of yoga practice was this?
Vinyasa yoga.
So you were already doing a kind of yoga practice that goes more deeply than maybe a power yoga type practice.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, sort of the place that I was studying and practicing was, the practice itself, although 100% movement based, was very contemplative. You know, it was very much about exploring the inner landscape and whatnot. So that part wasn't new, but doing it in stillness maybe was.
Yeah, it's similar to how I started too. I started with Tai Chi, which is also a stillness in movement practice, and it just sort of naturally progressed from there into wanting to learn more about sitting meditation.
Right.
Yeah. And were there particular experiences that you had or moments where, you know, kind of an aha moment where you thought, okay, this is what I want to do, or, you know, this is the direction I want to go?
I mean, I will say that the aha moment for me in terms of doing what I do now and teaching students and parents and teachers and really anyone who will let me, but the aha moment was actually when I did my training. So with Mindful Schools, I did their year-long program, and the year-long really emphasizes your own personal practice, the teacher's personal practice, as an intervention in the school. And that the notion that your presence, your ability to be non-reactive and to, you know, find calm and show up in that way for your colleagues, your peers, the people you're working with and talking to, that is something of importance already. That was huge for me. And so my real aha moment was in our first retreat, when we weren't really allowed to talk about kids, or we weren't allowed to talk at all for the first part of it. But you know, even when we came out of silence, the premise was, let's just talk about our personal practice. You know, we as caregivers are really in a rush to talk about how this will work in a classroom, or how you can do this with other people, or what you can kind of give away, but you know, you can't pour from an empty cup. And
right.
And so that was a big moment for me, and continues to resonate, you know, as my just sort of philosophical alignment in terms of what I'm doing is, I'm bringing a calm and steady presence first. Then I can also share a practice with you, but that comes from a place of just kind of trying to create a certain energy in my own person, in the room, and, you know, and work from there.
Yeah, so it's a little bit like Gandhi said, you must be the change, rather, you know, if you want to affect
sure.
others, you have to be that change yourself first.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. And what brought you from a meditation practice? Because so you started this meditation practice, and then mm-hmm. you got this interest into teaching it. So that's what brought you to Mindful Schools, right?
Yeah, I think my interest at the time was in stress, pretty specifically, you know, working with a population of, you know, upper, I teach a lot of, you know, 11th and 12th graders, and working with those kids who are going to college, and there's, you know, just all of this cultural baggage associated with those years and with that process. And it's kind of really hard to watch, frankly, the amount of uncertainty and the amount of anxiety and the amount of kind of the heaviness of judgment that they're clearly feeling, that their families are feeling, and expectation and all those things. And, you know, wanting to sort of help folks out with that and watching them do just these hours of homework and just sort of driving themselves into the ground at sort of what cost. So, you know, and I knew that in my own life, this was something that was very powerful. And so how do I share that? How do I kind of help create some sense of perspective, some sense of space, some mm-hmm. sense of ease, a greater sense of ease with kind of what's going on? And that was the motivation for me. And ironically, that was the thing that deepened my own practice. And luckily, I would say, but it was motivated out of the interest to teach them, but I had a lot more to learn myself first to be able to do that.
Right. And in terms of those stress and expectations, maybe you can expand a little bit more on that. What do you see as the biggest stressors? You know, is it expectations from society or the parents, or maybe just this is how we've always done it, or maybe the influence of drugs perhaps, or cell phone technology and things like that, bullying?
Yeah. You know, I think when I first began this work, and I've taught in both public and private settings, I've taught in urban and suburban settings. I would have said that it was the actual pressure of applying to college in many of the settings that I was working in that was kind of the biggest stressor for kids, at least as far as I was interacting with them in the classroom and in the school setting. I think that nowadays, actually, the trend towards the smartphone really has become a bigger stressor. So, you know, the anxiety of being away from this device, the anxiety of missing out, the FOMO, fear of missing out, right?
Right.
That they just experience. I mean, I've had folks, and I know that kids aren't alone in this. Adults are equally guilty, many adults.
Oh, yeah.
Of being quite glued to the device. But, you know, the extent to which I have heard things as ridiculous as, yes, I keep my smartphone with me next to the shower and I text while I'm showering, or, you know, some of these things, like the ability to not have any moment to yourself and to not have any moment of stillness. You sleep with it next to your head and whatnot. And again, those are maybe extremes, but the norm for sure is that their attention is pulled in many, many different directions. Our attention is pulled in so many different directions, and without much time at all to recover, to have stillness, to just think or hear yourself think or hear yourself not think, that I think that's the bigger and more pressing issue that, as I see it now.
Right. Yeah. And the fragmented attention, it just keeps, apparently the attention span just keeps getting shorter and shorter. And that must be
right.
Part of that.
Yeah, it's very hard. And the truth is, you know, when you actually create the conditions for folks to not have those pressures on them, you know, when in a classroom, devices away, devices off, or even collect devices, you know, let's put them at the front of the room and put them to sleep. Let's let them rest for a little while. I remember the first time when I became an administrator and started doing detentions, and, you know, not necessarily my favorite time, but surprisingly, the number of kids that actually thanked me for the hour without their device, you know, because they couldn't even have a laptop or something that they're used to taking notes on in class, like, wow. I got a lot done. This was really, could I do this? Can I come back next week? I thought, really? This is not actually supposed to be the thing that you want to come to.
That's amazing.
But that was telling. That was really telling for me that this is something that you're actually seeking. And it's something that you have a really hard time creating for yourself. But when the adults around you impose, okay, well, I have to go away from this device, so I can't respond to my friends or my parents. The number of parents that text their students during the day is pretty significant. You know, so that's, you know, they're also living in a world where they're expected to be in touch with every adult and person in their life, including, you know, their families. So again, it just keeps, and it keeps the brain in kind of that stress mode, or the it at least needs to be able to kind of respond to and ready for whatever that stimulus is, and the stimulus is constant.
Yeah, which makes it really hard to really delve into something and concentrate for a chunk of time.
Right.
Yeah. And do you see that the kids, because you mentioned that you have to force them almost to take some time and some space. It's like they almost need some permission, or they need to be taught how to give themselves permission to untether themselves for a while.
I think that's exactly right. And I think it's really hard for teenagers in particular, you know, which is with the, you know, that's the population with whom I work. They're developmentally at an age and at a time when the social world matters so much. And that's appropriate. That's, you know, that is how it goes in those years. And it's good. And you know, they're sort of figuring out who they are and figuring out who they are with respect to these other people that are, you know, their peers and whatnot. And they're trying to individuate from their parents and their families and come into their own. So all of that is good. You know, I don't suggest that's a negative, but that makes it that much harder for them to be away from this thing that connects them at all moments to this social network that is so powerful and so all important. So yeah, when there is the permission to put it away, it is kind of, for many folks, a sigh of relief. There's like a nice exhale. Oh, okay, I can just be here. I don't have to be anywhere else.
Right. And how do you implement this in your classroom? Do you start the period with a few minutes? Maybe you can show us how you do that.
Yeah. So, I mean, for starters, it's some of the norms. Like I said, you know, for some classes, they actually need devices. And for me, I say no devices unless we're doing something very specific. We're going to do a word processing task and I want you to write a paper or whatnot. But otherwise, they go away. And the truth is, you remember your notes better when you write them by hand, and we have a lot of good data about that, and things like that are helpful for kids. So, oh, this will actually help me studying, not hurt me. Okay, great. And they know that. So just the let's put everything else away so that we can be here. And then yes, we do begin with something that is contemplative, and usually it's silence, though not always. It kind of depends where we are in the day. You know, if it's right after lunch, movement is going to be much more helpful than just sitting.
Because they just fall asleep then.
Yeah. That is exactly what happens. Because they're exhausted too. They need more sleep than I do, than we do. And they usually don't get it. They usually get a lot less. So it depends a little bit. But I will often invite a student to lead us in the practice. And so generally, it's one of a couple things. I do one called a five-finger meditation, which is just to meet one finger to your palm of the opposite hand. And then as you breathe in, you trace up the pinky and breathe out and come back down. And then as you breathe in, you come up the fourth finger and back down, and so on and so forth. And then we switch hands. And so there's something really nice and tactile about that. You can just sort of follow the finger along the palm. And so there's a sense that they can follow. It's you know, there's movement involved without being too much of a big thing. There's no extra noise or anything special. And you know, by the time you've finished, you've just taken 10 nice slow breaths, and you're likely to have arrived. Well, also, I always have, you know, I carry a couple things into my different classroom. I carry my markers, and I carry the cable for connecting to the projector, and then I carry the bell. And that's always fun for kids too, generally. And we'll just listen to the sound of the bell once, twice, three times. And really, it's up to them. It's an easy one for kids to lead, you know, and they kind of feel important and fun. And even, you know, an 18-year-old feels like, oh, I'm the bell ringer today.
That's great.
They'll squat over it, or we have like a little schedule who gets to ring the bell.
So that way you're helping them invest into it, so that they take some ownership of it.
Right. And they do. And you know, it's about feeling out every class. Every class has a slightly different personality. Every room is different. You know, what does the room need? What do these kids need? What does the space need? And it's a little bit of trial and error, but usually a group responds to something and they feel, you know, it's that old thing of like, how can I get the teacher off topic to not teach us? Let me ask, you know, a zillion questions. How was your weekend? How was this? So every student in the history of time has done that. They're mm-hmm. feeling like, oh, I'm getting this thing where he's not teaching. Awesome. you get to do this instead. What they don't realize is that our spending 3 minutes on this makes us much better at the things that we're going to do later. You know, we're able to actually do more rather than do less. So from my perspective, it's also just a worthwhile investment in the actual stuff of teaching.
Right. And have you, because you mentioned experimenting, what are you finding to be the most helpful with the students not getting lost or drifting away with thoughts? And because you're using tactile and you mentioned sound, so that's kind of what you're doing then to to prevent that wandering.
Yeah, so I should say, and maybe this is kind of backing up, so in my own teaching, I teach a number of humanities classes. So I teach English and history and philosophy. Then I also teach to the 9th and 10th grade. I specifically teach mindfulness. So folks who have had that training, then they already are familiar with these practices too. So in terms of teaching the actual mindfulness classes to kids, I don't find that one specific thing is useful. I mean, I will say that, you know, at the beginning of a class or just for a quick calm down activity, the finger and palm activity really is my personal go-to. It's not for everyone, but I think it has maybe the widest appeal as I've practiced it. But that said, you know, when I talk to kids about what it is to practice mindfulness and how and where you might use this, I always say at the beginning, you know, you can kind of think of this like a buffet, or, you know, like you're going to the cafeteria, and I'm going to provide you a lot of different exercises here and a lot of different things. Try them all so you can kind of know how they feel, know how they taste. But hopefully one or two of these is going to stick out to you, and that's going to be different to everyone, even just in how we breathe. Where do you pay attention, you know, when you're breathing? Do you feel it in your nose or coming in your mouth? Do you feel it in your chest, in your belly? Do you feel it somewhere else in your body? Where are you even noting that sensation? That's going to be different for every one of us. And so, you know, we all have different ways of learning, which is why I write things on the board and I say them out loud and we read them and you talk to your neighbor and you write about it and you, you know,
right,
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just like you have different learning styles, we kind of all have different styles of attention, different things that are going to hold our attention, different things to be mindful of or to use as an anchor, use as a practice. So none is more right than anything else.
Right. And do you find some of the students, like they're learning these particular techniques and taking them somewhere else, like maybe, you know, at home when they're in a stress situation?
Yeah, and that's always, frankly, for me, the most gratifying is to hear, when are you using this? Where are you using this? How are you using this? So when a kid comes back and says, oh, I use my mindful breathing during a test, and I put down my pen and I just took a couple of deep breaths, and then I was able to come back to the test and I got back on track and it was really helpful. Or, oh, I had a, you know, a swim meet yesterday, and beforehand I closed my eyes and I visualized what I was going to do, and then I took a couple of breaths, or, you know, and so to hear from kids that they are actually applying this, I mean, to me, I try to talk a lot about how you might apply this so that it isn't just the thing that we're doing here in this classroom. That's cute. I mean, anyone can, you know, find some level of stillness or something in this classroom with the person who's there. But if you're able to use this in your life and recognize, like, ooh, I really got into it with my mom. And I had a student the other day who he's had some real struggles in terms of acting out, and acting out at school specifically as a symptom of some conflict at home, and knowing, oh, this will be something that, you know, upsets my family, and I kind of that's, this is like a thing I can do there in our arguing. But came to the notion of, well, I realized that my feelings about the situation and my behavior or how I choose to react about it are two different things. And I think that's kind of better for me because I was getting myself in trouble.
Wow, that's great.
Well, yes. Yes, you're right about that. And also, I am really blown away to hear that. So, yeah, I mean, they definitely make that connection.
Yeah, that's very insightful and transformative, what you're
right.
saying there.
And exactly, it's the kind of thing that, you know, in teaching, certainly in teaching social and emotional learning, we really want students to be able to kind of name their experience and be familiar with their experience. But then what do you do with that? And I think that's been in the world of social emotional education, we spend a lot of time talking about emotional intelligence or being able to kind of identify your inner landscape, which of course is a huge first step. But then what do I do about that if I then am able to turn that into some behavioral change, something that I do differently? And I think that's where mindfulness is often a very helpful tool for kids. So it's a great addition to the social emotional toolbox, as it were, for teachers.
Right. You know, it's like, I don't know who said that education shouldn't be the filling of a pail, but the lightning of a fire. And then Aristotle said, educating the mind without educating the heart is no education at all. So that it sounds like the approach your school is doing and you're doing is much more integrating these different facets rather than this compartmentalization that we've gone so much towards with our society.
That's right. And something that I try to emphasize, you know, I work with teachers and try to emphasize this notion that it's great that we have our classrooms and this content that we want to deliver. And you know, the students who show up in your classrooms, they are not just content receivers. They show up as their whole person and they bring their whole person to class. So if that's an argument that's carrying over from lunchtime, or if it's nerves about the game that's happening afterward, or, you know, all of that is sitting at that desk and trying to learn history,
right.
or trying to learn physics. And so the more that we can provide them the space and the tools to deal with one aspect of their life and be successful in one aspect of their life, it does carry over. It is all one integrated whole at the end of the day, or maybe not so integrated at all times, but the more we can work to help them integrate, the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like you're also, in that sense, helping see learning as a joy rather than something to just get over with so you can get to the next level or the next piece of paper so you can get a job and so forth. You know,
I would hope so.
Yeah.
I think all teachers kind of aim for that. You know, the real, some of the real gold and the way you know you're successful is you've created a lifelong learner. I don't delude myself into thinking that students will remember even a minority of what we do in a semester in any given classroom. I certainly don't, not because I didn't have good teachers or any of that, but you know, that's just the reality of our world. We provide something to build on, but if there are skills that you learn when you are with us, especially at, you know, this level, that to me is a much more important gift, because you're going to go on to learn in much greater depth the things that you need to use in your career and all of that. But have we provided you the capacity to learn them? And that's capacities of many different kinds. There's certain academic skills and other skills that you'll need, but then there are the other life skills, just to be a competent human being, to show up in a room with other people. And really at the end, you know, my head of school currently, we're a high school that's actually only 4 years old. The school itself is much older, but our high school division is only 4 years old. And as we're building this project, one of the things my head of school said was, I will know, I'll be able to measure the success of this project by whether or not there is joy in our
wow.
students.
That's great. Me,
that's, yeah, right?
That's very different from saying I'll measure success by how many, you know, the scores and stuff.
It's true. I mean, obviously, all of it's important. And unfortunately, we do live in a world where we measure. I mean, it's kind of impossible not to. So,
right.
So I don't think those things are automatically bad. And it's not wrong for families or students or colleges or other folks to try to get a sense of, like, who are these kids and who is this school and what is all this? You know, we need some way to understand that. And
right.
numbers are helpful, but they're not the only way. And, you know, when you reduce a person to just test scores or transcript or any of those things, you know, right, it ignores how much of their experience, most of it.
It's very limited. I mean, if they don't include things like you just said, joy, then it becomes very limited.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. What are some of the other benefits, you know, like, for example, in terms of the way conflict resolution is affected by these mindfulness practices and, you know, mm-hmm. maybe some mm-hmm. other things that you've noticed since you've implemented this skill, life skill?
Yes. So in another hat that I wear, I am a grade dean, and so this means I'm the primary administrator for one of the classes, and you know that includes discipline among the other things. And something that has been particularly key for kids is the moment when you know I won't pretend that teaching mindfulness automatically makes any difficult moments go away, right? That's not what we're trying to
right.
do. It's trying to get a toolbox to navigate them differently or deal with them differently. And so teenagers who are already particularly impulsive, and that's just a developmental vulnerability. I always say to folks, you know, you got another 10 years before that stuff comes in, you know, the frontal lobe, the prefrontal cortex, all of those things, they have some extra time that they have to wait before their good judgment kicks in.
Right.
Compared to those of us adults. So but yes, the ability for them after the fact, even after they have maybe made a decision that they recognize wasn't the greatest, the ability to stop and slow down and figure out, how did that even happen? What just happened? What do I feel about that? What do I need to do about that? And I think so often that impulsivity comes at the cost of any self-knowledge. So I'll watch kids get in an argument or a tiff with either friends or, you know, an adult, you know, whatever kind of scuffle they might have. And it's not till it's over that they could say, oh, okay, here's what led me to that. And I realized that that was the moment that I probably should have made a different decision. But the truth is that these same kids, without this practice, may not have been able to even name that.
Right.
And so that means they couldn't do it differently next time. I mean, part of this is just becoming aware of our triggers and our habits and all of the ways that we're used to doing things impulsively, right, without thinking, doing them mindlessly. And so when you have some awareness of, oh, this is what got me to this poor decision, or this is what got me to this behavior that I definitely don't want to repeat, so here's what I'm going to do next time. And being able to sit there and figure out, all right, next time this comes, next time this trigger happens, next time I notice this habit, here's what I have to do so that I can take a different turn, so it doesn't go down this exact same road.
Yeah, that's amazing. And that road can lead, you know, 50 years from now into a totally different direction
mm-hmm.
if they didn't have that consciousness and awareness and attention.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah,
it's very powerful, you know, to watch kids. And I have the advantage that in my administrative role, I actually follow the grade through 4 years. So having watched them as ninth graders, and then watching them as 11th graders and really knowing, oh, okay, here I remember how this went in ninth grade. I remember how this went in 10th grade, and I'm watching you make different choices now. that's great. That is great to see.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see this in the future? Do you see this? Is this school going to have it all the way from kindergarten all the way to college? I mean, where do you see it going, this practice?
Specifically for our school or in general?
Yeah, I'm not sure yet if your school is connected to an elementary school, but I mean, ideally, of course, you'd like to see that get started as soon as possible with young folks, and then all the way into to college, so that by the time they leave college, that these practices are, you know, very well used, and they're not going to be easily cast aside.
That's right. You know, I think so. We do have pre-K through 12 now as a school, and I do see some of my elementary school colleagues doing it as well. You know, I think the truth is, I think that I don't have hard numbers on this. I don't think anyone does, though. There's some great interest in really trying to catalog all of the mindfulness teaching that's happening in K to 12 education. And there have been some attempts at it. It's for obvious reasons really a difficult thing. But my sense is that more elementary school classrooms are doing this because those classrooms are already charged with social emotional learning. That's just part of what happens in a kindergarten or a third grade classroom or anything. You know, one of the things you learn in kindergarten is how to sit still, and I learned crisscross applesauce so that I can sit here and listen to story time with my teachers. You know, we don't teach those things in high school, although actually we should, it turns out. You know, these are folks who are living in a really different body than they were when they're in kindergarten, and we kind of make some assumptions that, oh, you know how to sit here. You don't, and many adults don't. It's not unique to them. So I think it's an easier map onto the elementary classroom. And so folks who are just kind of looking for yet another thing, folks who teach in a model called the responsive classroom, which allows for classroom meeting time, is something that a lot of folks will just use a bell or whatnot. It's an easy in for elementary school teachers. I happen to think it's an easy in for middle and high school as well, for all the reasons that, you know, we've talked about, and mm-hmm. all the games, all the things that it provides, just if nothing else, learning outcomes, right? The productivity
exactly
to it, which is of course not the only reason to do it. And I know there's significant, debate and conversation about using mindfulness for those sorts of outcomes, but they're real. And if that's what allows us to bring this into a classroom, whatever doorway
exactly
someone comes in through is the right one for them. So I'm not concerned particularly about that. To the larger question of really, like, where are we going as an education system with this? I do think that because of the undeniable increase in distractions, just right, all the devices and the stimuli that we are, you know, the increased pace of those things. I do think that we are seeing a movement, a larger trend towards really needing to teach these things, needing to teach attention, needing to teach and provide stillness and quiet and some of those things. So it really wouldn't surprise me if 10 years from now, this was the kind of thing that started to become just standard. Mm-hmm. There's a tremendous interest in it. And most teachers, many teachers that I talk to really are thinking along these lines of, like, gosh, I wish I knew how to, you know, dot, 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 and you name it. And it's all the things that mindfulness does provide, that a mindfulness practice provides to kids. I should say one caveat about that, you know, is that there's some concern of mindfulness being used as a tool for compliance, as a tool for classroom management. I want you to behave this way, so I'm going to teach you this thing so that you'll do what I say, so that you'll shut up, so that you'll sit still, so that you'll whatever. And I see would see that as a misuse of mindfulness. But I also don't really, it hasn't been my experience in working with teachers that that has been the approach that they have taken, especially when the conversation or when a teacher is approaching this because they too have practiced mindfulness.
Yeah, I would think that, that that's the kind of thing that would happen if the teacher themselves hasn't really truly understood what it's about, and therefore is just using an external tool.
And I think folks are pretty sensitive to that. You know, those of us in this community who are really trying to bring the work forward, I can say, you know, as I mentioned with mindful schools, the very clear philosophical orientation is towards teacher practice first. And even if no one got any farther than learning mindfulness for themselves, that would be a tremendous victory, I think, in education in this country. To get into any mindful schools class, you must first pass through the gateway of either having a mindfulness practice, you know, that you bring, that you already have, or going through a mindfulness fundamentals course and really know what this is in your body. We would never stick someone into a classroom to teach the cello that doesn't know how to play the cello, that doesn't play the cello. Or, you know, you couldn't stick a math teacher in to teach pre-calculus that
right.
doesn't know how to do algebra, right? So it's got to come from yourself and your own experience first.
Yeah, you got to practice what you preach.
Mm-hmm.
And just for just to wrap this up, for folks who are Christian Judeo type tradition, because your school has mm-hmm. kind of that as the, its roots. And was there
yes.
any some folks who might be listening who are from similar rooted schools, would they have any issues adopting a mindfulness practice? With some parents might be afraid that it's a Buddhist influence, or what would you say to that?
Right. You know, there are, in different settings, different approaches make sense. I actually think that schools with any kind of a faith background, usually there is more space for this because the topic of spirituality in general is already on the table. So we're not necessarily afraid of the notion of contemplative time or contemplative practice. Schools that have prayer or some other things already as part of their day, or just silence as part of their day, are maybe more open, not exclusively. And I think, for us, we are affiliated with the Episcopal Church. We're an Episcopal school, but we are not a parochial school. So we are actually a school for children of all faiths and no faith. And we don't specifically teach in the same way that some Catholic schools or other parochial schools are specifically inclined to teach Christianity in maybe a different way. That said, I think the question is a good one, and it's a really relevant one in terms of just religious influence and whatnot. I think to me, my very strong belief is that mindfulness is not a religious, mindfulness specifically involves a set of human practices of what it means to exist in a human body and this human mind and the human brain and the space and stillness that we can and I think really need to find, and in a way that science is starting to back up with some conclusiveness, and obviously all of that research is still very young mm-hmm. by scientific standards, but it's really pointing us in a direction that says, no, we really do need to provide ourselves space and stillness, and here's what happens when we do. I think that is an innate human quality or an innate human capacity to have self-knowledge, to see one's own thoughts and experience, to feel the sensations in your body. And there can be a spiritual layer to that that is quite profound. That's, for sure. But I don't think it has to be, and I don't think that that has to or should really, in the school setting, be what we're teaching.
Right.
I'm teaching stillness. I'm teaching silence. I'm teaching self-knowledge, the ability to be aware of what is going on in your own immediate experience. And, you know, what comes of that, where that leads for certain students versus others, you know, it's totally up to them. Even the bell that I use, I don't use the Tibetan singing bowl. In fact, like I see folks do that, and I know, you know, I get that, and that's fine. That to me has a pretty clear cultural reference, which actually in my setting is fine. It wouldn't be a problem. We also teach Buddhism and Hinduism, and also we teach world religions, we teach philosophy, Eastern philosophy. That's just part of the program that students take. Mm-hmm. But yes, I think again, it's not my personal goal. And I don't specifically identify as Buddhist, though I find interest in Buddhist practices, but I'm teaching something a little bit different than that.
Yeah, no, I think you explained it really well. It's space and having room to breathe and self-knowledge. Those are not any religion's domain. That's the human experience. Yeah.
Right. And all religions have some aspect of contemplative practice. It's
exactly.
There in every religious practice. So for those who are concerned about religion at all, I would say really what we're doing isn't religious. For those who are concerned about their own religious tradition, you know, I think this is found in most all of them. In fact, one of my colleagues and our counseling staff, she is an Orthodox Jew, and was really interested in what we were doing and participated in our mindfulness program and helped to bring a mindfulness group to our parents, you know, but was really kind of cautious around how does this work with my own set of faith practices. And you know, we looked together for some opportunities for retreats over the summer. And, you know, she had some trepidation around like, where might I be going? I don't want to be somewhere with like Buddhist iconography. That's not what I'm seeking. You know, she has found a number of you know, Jewish organizations in New York City that are teaching. You know, the JCC in Manhattan is teaching, you know, has its own MBSR courses and whatnot. It's out there, including with a faith bent, if that's the direction you're looking for. So I really do think this is open to whichever angle. Again, it's back to that idea of whatever door you're coming in through, or whatever door you're trying to go through into. This is a practice that is there for folks.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I really appreciate you you delving into that and explaining that well for the folks listening. And if anybody listening wants to see that in their schools, like a parent might want to ask their school if when they're going to implement some mindfulness in their school, or maybe a teacher listening might want to start the program, what would they do?
Sure. Well, you know, again, my own affiliation is with Mindful Schools, and I happen to really believe very strongly in the teachings as they are providing them. And that is mindfulschools.org. But by the same token, this is a movement that is really taking off, and there are lots of folks doing this in many different local areas as well. You know, so certainly not the only people doing this, but Mindful Schools is a great starting place. And like I said, there are so many good organizations that are really trying to bring this into schools. But yes, I think it's a conversation that people are more and more open to. So for parents, just even raising the question, where are we teaching this? You know, and it's helpful to my child, or I'm seeing this at home and I'm wondering, is there an opportunity when my child is going to get exposed to this? Is there an opportunity for me as a parent to learn this? You know, mindful parenting or mindfulness in parenting is for sure an important companion skill, because if your child is learning something at school and you're not having that same language at home, you know, it doesn't grow in that space. For teachers, you know, same thing. I think talk to the department chair, the administrator, the principal, the person who does professional development, and really see, is there some openness to what looking into this for your school or your classroom, the benefits that it might provide, because the benefits are so many, you know?
Yeah.
And leading with the benefits and the intention of doing good for kids, doing good for faculty, doing good for parents, whatever the population is, I think people are certainly more open to hearing this and investigating this now. Folks want solutions for some of the real challenges that we're seeing in our children and the challenges that they're having. So,
yeah, that's for sure. Well, it's been wonderful to talk to you, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thank you for putting this information out there, for putting your... Oh, there's a siren in the background. I apologize for that.
No, that's New York, right?
Yep. It's just another sound to listen to.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's been great to talk to you, and thanks again.
You as well. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this interview with Alan Brown. You can find the show notes to this particular episode by going to meditationfreedom.com/32. And feel free to comment if you have any questions for Alan, additional questions that were not discussed during this episode. So I hope you have a wonderful rest of your evening. I know we just had a super moon, and by the time you're listening to this, the super moon will be long done. But it was a interesting evening here over the desert, seeing that moon change from red to then being covered up with shadow and then back to bright white. It was quite an interesting change to the moon. Well, that's it for tonight. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week. Take care.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Meditation Freedom Podcast, where meditation meets daily life.